This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscowain. If you are an ex-smoker, as I am, then you know how hard it can be to quit. Now imagine that you're poor. You're struggling to stretch your dollars to pay your rent and utilities, feed and clothe your family, and keep them safe in a high-crime neighborhood. Cigarettes can be one way of coping with stress, which is why you see higher rates of smoking in low-income neighborhoods, and that's certainly true here in Philadelphia. But as we all know, smoking is hazardous to your health, and according to the CDC, the leading preventable cause of death in the United States. So today in Radio Times, what can be done to help with smoking cessation, especially for at-risk, low-income residents? And we have two guests who have joined us. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Dan Romer, and he's director of the Adolescent Communication Institute of the Annenberg Public Policy Center, and that's at the University of Pennsylvania. And Dan Romer, nice to have you with us in the studio on Radio Times.
It's great to be here.
And joining us by telephone is Bradley Collins, Associate Professor of Public Health at Temple University, also here in Philadelphia. He directs the Health Behavior Research Clinic, providing services to help people quit smoking. And Brad Collins, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Happy to be here, and good morning, Dan.
Hey, good morning to you, too.
And to our listeners, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Brad, if I can begin with you, and let's begin with some good news. Yes, we have millions of people who smoke in this country, but those numbers have gone down in the last, generation or so. So that's something I guess we should celebrate.
Yes, I absolutely agree. I think, one of the things I remind smokers who come to our clinic for help is that, try to encourage them that and remind them that millions of people quit smoking around the world every year. So it is something that can be accomplished. It's something that's very difficult. And as you mentioned, it's more difficult for people that are living in stressful environments. But there should be some encouragement that you can quit smoking. And there are ways to try, and some people have greater challenges than others. But, yes, there is good news.
And help us understand, Brad, the connection between poverty and smoking. In my introduction, I just talked about the stress of being poor. But flesh that out for us, if you could.
Sure. I think, first of all, there's a well-established link between smoking and stress, as well as smoking and depressive symptoms. And as you mentioned, living in financial hardship and neighborhoods that are deprived and have high crime rates are extreme sources of stress for people that live in poverty. And for people that live in poverty and smokers in general, frankly, sometimes smoking is one of the few strategies that they use to manage stress and negative moods. There's a biological connection to that, but also a habit that forms where over many years of smoking, people begin to rely on smoking and nicotine to help to manage their stress. And that becomes the primary way that they do that, the primary method.
And we're talking about, of course, the addictive properties of smoking as well, that adds to the habit.
Yes. Yep.
Let me get you in on the conversation, Dan, because you've been doing health research for some time now and with a particular interest in smoking. First of all, how did you get interested in smoking?
Well, I'm a health researcher, and at the Policy Center, we try to figure out ways, strategies to help people cope with health problems, prevent health problems. And smoking, because it is one of the largest preventable health problems in the country, it's a natural for us to look at that. So we started looking at what do people know about the risks of smoking, especially in adolescence, because adolescents are the ones who start. And that's where it begins, and then it just grows from there. And once adolescents start, they have a very hard time to quit. And our focus is on adolescents in particular. So it was a natural topic for us to look at.
And you told me before we began the show that 43 million Americans 18 and older do smoke.
Yeah, it's a huge number. It's about the same number as back in the 60s. Now, the prevalence has gone down a lot. It used to be over 40%. Now it's down below 20. But in terms of absolute numbers of smokers, it's surprising that in the country today, there are about as many smokers as there were back in 1965 when it was at its peak.
Would you say these are the hardcore smokers? Because there's so much messaging now about everyone knows smoking is bad for you.
Absolutely. And it's, as we know, it's very hard to quit. But over the years, people have quit, especially people who are light smokers. I know you quit.
I was a light smoker.
You were
a long time light smoker.
Yeah, I was a light smoker at one time. I quit. People who are heavier smokers, which is what's true of a lot of those 43 million, are going to have a much harder time. But what's happened over the last 15, 20 years is that people are smoking less. At least that's what they tell us when we do surveys. So now about half of the smokers are smoking less than 15 a day, they report. So that's a good sign, because the less you smoke, the easier it's going to be, as you know, to quit.
Let me go back to you, if I could, Brad. And I was looking at some recent research looking at Philadelphia and some of these low-income areas, that the smoking rate in some of these areas for, I guess it would be for adults, is something like 40%. That's a lot of smoking.
That is a lot of smoking, and it's certainly higher than the national average. On the one hand, it's good news that you look at trends over time and smoking rates are decreasing in general and in the general populations, as Dan was kind of highlighting. But then you have populations that have greater challenges to quitting smoking, and that would include people that live in poverty. And so you see the general population rates decreasing, and in populations that have, unfortunately, higher risks associated with smoking also have greater challenges quitting. So, yeah, I agree. It's a high rate.
And what does it cost to buy a pack of cigarettes these days?
Well, that varies on where you live. One of the frustrations is in Philadelphia. It's relatively inexpensive. I mean, it's an expensive addiction. But compared to other states and other cities, Philadelphia, the cost of cigarettes averages around $5 a pack. So, it can be much higher in other cities, closer to $10 a pack.
So we're talking, and especially if we're talking about people, low-income people, obviously they're poor. They're making a decision to spend a lot of money on their cigarettes.
Yes. Yeah, that's one of the unfortunate consequences as well.
And should we think of it as an addiction?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think the way we describe to our clients is that there's two parts to addiction. One part is the biological part, so to speak, that has to do with changes that occur in the brain when you've been smoking for a number of years that create a situation that when you have periods of time in between cigarettes or in between doses of nicotine, a smoker experiences withdrawal symptoms, which any smoker, light or heavy smoker, has experienced, either during periods, long periods in between cigarettes or when they're trying to quit smoking. And smoking is addictive physically or biologically because smoking temporarily reduces these withdrawal symptoms and therefore reinforces the ongoing dosing. But there's also habits around smoking. And part of that gets to the link between smoking and stress and depression. Certainly there's a biological link, but imagine when you are experiencing stress and you try different strategies and smoking alleviates that stress, then it creates an expectation that, well, when any time you experience stress, maybe one of the first things you reach for is a cigarette, and that continues to get reinforced biologically and through the behavioral habit.
Because of at least the momentary positive association.
Exactly, yes.
Dan, do you want to weigh in on this as well? And just as someone who's been looking at the connection, the powerful connections that people feel to that cigarette and to smoking. Now, we don't have advertisements the way we did probably when you and I were growing up, but nonetheless, cigarettes are legal and readily available.
They really are, and as Brad was pointing out, they are a little cheaper here than in a lot of the large cities, especially on the East Coast and Chicago. And so city council is actually proposed raising the price of cigarettes by $2 a pack, which would potentially help a bit in discouraging people from smoking.
That does work? The more you raise the price?
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence that that's one of the most effective ways, is just make it more expensive. New York City now, it's like, I think, $11 a pack, and they have a lower smoking rate than Philadelphia, probably as a result of that. But years of research has shown that that's the case. The other thing that's happening in Philly, which I think is good, is there was a study done by some folks at Penn, Amy Hillier in particular, looking at storefronts in the city. And there was just a huge preponderance of stores in poor neighborhoods that had storefront ads for cigarettes. So, you know, you would walk by one of these stores and all you saw were packs of cigarettes plastered all over the wall with a price and, you know, enticing people to go in the store and buy cigarettes. Well, the zoning board has now put in place a restriction on the size of advertising on storefronts, which isn't directed at tobacco per se, but it's making it harder to put all those ads out front on all of these. There's just more storefronts in poor neighborhoods that sell cigarettes, and they're more likely to sell cigarettes to kids. So getting rid of these lures that will, you know, attract a smoker, because smokers are definitely attracted to
it. I mean, that's the kind of trigger, right?
It's a trigger. You see a pack of cigarettes on a storefront, and if you have one of these urges, you're going to want to go in and buy them. And if they're not that expensive, you're even more likely to go in and buy them. So that was, I think, a very important move by the city. So there are things that are happening here in Philly that might actually help.
Brad, I was also reading that it's possible to buy individual cigarettes as opposed to a whole pack. And I wonder how much that feeds someone's addiction.
Well, yeah. I was thinking the same thing, Marty, when you right before you asked that question. The city is doing a great job. The City Department of Health is doing a great job in trying to address issues such as what Dan has been talking about. But even so, there is, a black market that develops. In stores you can purchase, some stores you can purchase what are called loosies, LOOSIES, and single cigarettes. But there's also a black market that develops when cigarettes get expensive, just like any other addictive drug. When it becomes less and less available or less and less possible to purchase it legally, then people look for it if they're dependent and have no other resources to help them quit using. Then they look for other ways to access the drug. So a lot of people that come into our clinic do report smoking what they call loosies, single cigarettes, and bumming them off the street.
Well, you know what? Hold on to that thought only because we're up on a break here, and I do want to quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Bradley Collins. He's Associate Professor of Public Health at Temple University, directs the Health Behavior Research Clinic. Here with us in our Philadelphia, you're both in Philadelphia, but in our downtown studio is Dan Romer, Director of the Adolescent Communication Institute of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. We're talking about smoking and poverty today on Radio Times. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Hill School supports WHYY, a private co-educational boarding school located in Pottstown. The Hill School provides students in grades 9 through 12 with the essentials for college, careers, and life in a diverse learning and living community. Hill students come from across the country and around the world. They are athletes, artists, friends, classmates, and future leaders. An open house is Saturday, October 26th at 9:30 a.m. Information available at 610-326-1000 or online at thehill.org.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're in the middle of the fall membership campaign here at WHYY. If you are a member subscriber, we thank you for your support. We could not do this without you. If you're not a member yet, take just a few minutes and become one since you're listening to Radio Times. That phone number is 1-888-345-9499, and you can pledge online at WHYY.org. For a $60 pledge, we'll send you a Radio Times mug designed by our very own Tony Auth. So do it, please. Thanks.
The Philadelphia Orchestra and Rafael Frubeck de Burgos perform Debussy's incandescent seascape La Mer and Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe. Tickets are available at 215-893-1999 or at philorc.org. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, La Mer and more with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about smoking in this hour of Radio Times. I began by confessing, yes, I was a smoker, smoked for far too long, not a heavy smoker, as our guest Dan Romer said, but nonetheless, we know something about the kind of denial that can go along with smoking. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And again, talking with Temple University's Bradley Collins and also with Dan Romer from the University of Pennsylvania from the Annenberg Center. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Dan, let me go back to you because as we did a show about when those new cigarette packages came out with the warnings and the possibility of these really gruesome looking pictures on the packages of cigarettes. Is that an effective message?
Well, it's a very easy and effective way to reach smokers, probably the best way, because they're going to buy packs of cigarettes. It'll be on every pack. And if it's on the, you know, half of the front and back of a pack, it's going to be hard to ignore. The other thing that's good about them is they're quite emotionally arousing. You look at those pictures and
scary,
you say,
actually.
They're scary. And you say, why am I doing this? So there's quite a bit of research that shows that if you can give people that little bit of an emotional kick that reminds them that what they're doing is not the healthiest thing for them, it'll get them to think about quitting. It's particularly effective probably for lighter smokers. Heavier smokers, we're not so sure. The jury's still out on that. But there is evidence that lighter smokers will act on these messages, and it's unfortunate that the courts have held up that implementing that process. But I think FDA is going to continue to pursue it, and eventually we will have these larger warnings, like a lot of the rest of the world has by now.
And there was some First Amendment issue, I think, having to do with this kind of messaging.
Yeah. So the tobacco companies, and I suppose from their point of view, rightly so, thought, you know, why would I want to have half my pack covered with awful pictures of people suffering from my product? So, yeah. And they were able to make a First Amendment case that they were not justified, that FDA was not justified in putting those pictures on there. But FDA is going to work on that, and they'll get to the point, I think, where that'll get through.
What do you think about those kind of gruesome messages, Brad Collins?
I agree with Dan. I think they are effective, particularly for lighter smokers and potentially for younger smokers. He would be the expert in that area.
Right.
I think what we try to do is we look at those kind of messages as kind of part of a number of different messages that we try to integrate to clients. And colleagues and I are testing multi-level interventions, which try to integrate messages from, say, the city department of health and their public health campaigns with provider information that can encourage and motivate people to quit smoking, and then more intensive messaging that can come from behavioral counseling and counselors that can help navigate people to the right types of resources that are available at relatively low cost, if not free, through insurance to smokers. So I think it's the way that you could potentially look at it is that any one type of strategy alone may not be effective in a population of people who are trying to quit smoking. However, if you can combine multiple types of messages, that can increase or potentiate the chance that people can get that nudge and support that they need to quit smoking.
But it seems, if smoking is a coping mechanism for someone dealing with the stresses of poverty, let's say, or even living in a high-crime neighborhood, and that often goes hand in hand, you have to figure out what to substitute for that, Brad.
Yeah, and that's a large part of what we do. We had worked with the city for a couple of years under a CDC grant that they had received to provide smoking cessation to people that had depressive disorders, anxiety disorders, as well as people who were living in poverty, unemployed individuals. And that was one of the opportunities for us to work with smokers to help develop alternative strategies for managing stress other than smoking. And right now we're testing, in a clinical trial, we're testing strategies where people get randomized to either get coaching for physical activity, moderate physical activity, such as walking every day and walking to help manage stress, as well as, relaxation mm-hmm. training to help develop other strategies for managing stress before they quit smoking. And then after 4 weeks of training in these alternate strategies to manage stress, then we help them through the quitting process for another period of time.
Right. I mean, and that takes time, and there are many issues at stake. Dan, you had mentioned the fact that most people begin smoking when they're teenagers, right?
Yeah.
When it's actually illegal, right, if you're under 18?
Well, it's illegal to buy them.
To buy them, yeah. But not to smoke them.
Well, you know, I guess it's hard to have a law about that. But, yeah, and, of course, those laws are unequally enforced. They may not be enforced as well in poor neighborhoods where we can get loosies, and there's much less checking, you know, for identification and age. But yeah, and adolescents get cigarettes. You know, there's 43 million adults out there smoking, so it's not too hard to imagine that a young person in a household with smokers is going to have access to cigarettes, and they're going to have a role model for how to smoke and potentially see that one can do it. You know, it's very easy to learn how to do that when you're an adolescent. But the good news is, of course, that this has been going down. The rate of adolescent smoking has been dropping. Adolescents are listening and they're getting the message.
Okay.
So that's encouraging. Also, there's less content in films, probably on television, although we're not so sure about cable.
Breaks a lot of the rules. Yes.
Yeah, cable may be a different story. But as far as we can tell, a lot of the imaging that would support, you know, trying, you know, that it's a cool habit to have, has declined on in the movies and on television. So that's good. And that's helped in part to also, along with pricing, to reduce the prevalence of smoking in young people.
We often call young people the young invincibles. You know, they think that they're invincible. That's part of being an adolescent. And I wonder if you make smoking uncool, whether that sort of taps into that psychology.
Yeah, well, the Legacy Foundation had a massive campaign to try to do that, and there's evidence that that worked. You know, that kids are being duped by the tobacco companies into thinking that this is a cool habit when it really isn't. That definitely seems to help.
You want to weigh in on that, Brad, and then we'll get to some of our callers.
Yeah, I was chuckling because I have a teenager, so I've seen.
You know what we're talking about? Yes,
invincibility. Yeah, and So I totally agree with that. That's a good point.
Well, and also the idea of you know the tobacco companies are out to dupe. They think you're an easy mark, right?
Yep.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, this is anecdotal, but, you know, we've certainly heard a number of times from different clients that one of the biggest motivators for them quitting smoking, when they live in these neighborhoods where the tobacco industry is pumping in so much money to target advertising, that, one of the biggest motivators is the feeling that, that they're being manipulated by the tobacco industry.
That makes sense to you, Dan?
It does. And the other thing that adolescents are commonly believe is that they can quit. And, you know, you think this is something you can just try. And lo and behold, over time, that gets much, much harder. So you get into the habit, and next thing you know, it's extremely hard to quit.
Well, we are talking about smoking in this hour of Radio Times. Although many people have quit over the years, something like 43 million adults do smoke in this country. As Dan would say, was telling us, that number has remained consistent. Of course, we're a larger population. Nonetheless, that's a lot of people that do smoke. And we are also finding out about the fact that for many poor people, smoking is one way to deal with some of the stresses of poverty, some of the depression and anxiety associated with poverty as well. And again, our guests are Dan Romer, director of the Adolescent Communication Institute of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania, Bradley Collins, joining us by telephone, associate professor of public health at Temple University and directs the Health Behavior Research Clinic, providing services to help people quit smoking. Let me see what our callers say at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Let me see what Charlie from Wilmington, Delaware has to say. Charlie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Molly. Yes, I work for a major food company, and next year my health care provider is going to be charging me an extra $100 a month for every smoker in my family. Now, I don't smoke, but my wife does, so she'll be assessed that payment every month unless she quits. I don't think that's fair.
Well, and I guess, is that a part of the new Affordable Care Act, Charlie?
No. This is on top of our regular monthly payment.
Right. That your premiums are going up because you have people in your family who smoke. Let me see what Brad Collins says and then Dan Romer. Brad, does that surprise you?
My first reaction, I think, is parallel to Charlie's. That does sound pretty frustrating. And my reaction would be, I would hope that that the company would offer some sort of support, support or services to their employees to help their family members quit smoking.
Yeah. What do you think, Dan?
Yeah, well, insurance companies are kind of mercenary about this. You know, they know the risks are higher if you have a family member who smokes. They're going to have more illness, so they're going to want to charge more. And I agree with Brad that if they're going to do that, they ought to try to help people. Now, with the Affordable Care Act, presumably we're going to have more people seeing primary care physicians who are going to counsel people to quit. Rather than going to emergency rooms where nobody's ever going to ask, do you smoke? If you go to a doctor, hopefully docs are going to start asking that question and giving people advice about how to quit. So there is some hope on that front that might help.
Charlie, thanks for the call and good luck as well. We got an email from Christine who said smoking is a legal habit. Why are they demonized while alcoholics and obese people are approached with compassion? And I think it's an interesting question, Brad, and I'm sure something that you have wrestled with, which is we are talking about something that we know is bad for us, but it is legal in this country. And I think a lot of smokers do feel as if they walk a kind of walk of shame because they do smoke.
Yeah, I mean, certainly with the with the advent of smoke-free policies over the last 10, 15 years across the country, there has been more and more of a stigma associated with smoking. So it's understandable that smokers feel that way. But I can reassure any smoker that feels that way that they do get met with compassion by people who are in the smoking cessation industry, counselors, public health providers, health clinicians. There is compassion, but it is mm-hmm. a challenge in communities where there are fewer and fewer smokers, it's easier for non-smokers to speak out about concerns about secondhand smoke. So there is a stigma that is frustrating. But there is compassion out there for people who are trying to quit. It's very difficult to quit smoking.
Yeah. And do you think there's some truth to that, Dan, which is that non-smokers look down on smokers, seeing them as, weak and shameful?
Probably, yeah. And there is a stigma attached. And, nowadays, when you can't smoke inside buildings, you see smokers outside having to smoke. And, I think they probably feel very conspicuous out there. Doing what they used to be able to do indoors. So, yeah.
But do you think making it harder to smoke has helped people quit? And by that, I mean, you know, you can't smoke in this building, like most buildings in this country. That does make it, if not quit, it certainly reduced the amount of smoking.
Yeah, I think over the last 10 or so years, it's helped to get down the number of cigarettes that people smoke, because you can't smoke at work very easily. Can't smoke in a lot of public buildings. Can't smoke in restaurants now in Philly due to clean air laws. So it's going to be harder to smoke more cigarettes. And the fewer cigarettes people smoke, hopefully the easier it'll be for them to eventually quit.
Let me see what Dave from media has to say. Charlie, thanks for the call. Dave, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Just a little background. My wife and I are both in our mid-50s. She has smoked since we were teenagers. And, you know, we both grew up. I grew up around cigarettes. My father smoked. Everybody smoked. It never bothered me before. I never really thought much about it. But, of course, I'd like her to quit for her health. But because there doesn't seem to be any smoking anywhere I go anymore, I think I've become more sensitive to it. Mm. And it really bothers me, basically, even though she smokes outside. And I didn't know if there you could offer any advice. She doesn't seem to want to talk about it at all. If I even, I just don't mention it because I know it's going to cause a problem. Is there any general way to broach the subject, with her?
Well, David, it's a really important question, and I think there are a lot of people that probably feel some of your same frustration. And let me see what Brad Collins has to say. What are your thoughts, Brad?
Dave, that's a tough situation, and you're not alone. I think it's a challenge. It's not unusual that you would be experiencing some discomfort with exposure to secondhand smoke. I think, you know, as much as you could be supportive, it's certainly at some point, every smoker considers quitting smoking. Perhaps your wife is someone who maybe hasn't gotten to that point yet, but certainly if you can make sure that she's availed of has available information about the variety of quit smoking options that are there, that from group counseling services that are available for free to quit lines that are available, as well as online resources that are available where you can get advice. There's the National Cancer Institute has a mobile smoking app called QuitPal that has helped a lot of people. Sometimes it's a matter of just trying to find what opportunities click with a smoker. A misnomer that a lot of people have is that there's, one particular strategy for quitting smoking. But I can tell you there's no one-size-fits-all strategy, and sometimes it's a matter of timing, which sounds like that might be an issue, as well as just finding what the right fit might be for your wife.
Let me see what Dan Romer has to say. Anything you want to add to that, Dan?
Well, I think what Brad pointed out about most smokers at some point want to quit. And the more they smoke, the more they want to quit. So our caller may not realize how much, his wife, I think it's his wife we're talking about.
Yes, it is.
Wants to quit. And he may be able to leverage some of those feelings, at least when she is thinking hard about it, to help her. Get nicotine. The city gives away nicotine patches. You just call them; they'll give you 8 weeks' worth. There's ways to get the ball rolling for a smoker who's probably harboring those feelings. They're very conflicted, most of them.
Indeed.
They know it's not healthy. They have a hard time stopping, but they want to quit. So.
Well, Dave, we wish you the best of luck, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me take another short break in the show, then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about smoking. We began by talking about the connection, the correlation between smoking and poverty, but that has, of course, opened up a whole discussion about smoking, the difficulties of stopping. And again, our guests are Bradley Collins and Dan Romer, and we have just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Cornwall Manor, an active senior living community in Cornwall, Lebanon County. Situated on a 190-acre wooded campus, this community offers independence, wellness, and fitness activities, educational and musical programs, and the peace of mind of on-site healthcare if needed. Cornwall Manor's range of residential choices includes apartments and homes, including their newest options, the Carriage House and the Grove. Details and tour information online at cornwallmanor.org.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Today on the show, we're talking about the importance of financial literacy and the connection between smoking and poverty, especially here in Philadelphia. Speaking of financial literacy, we have budgets and have to pay our bills just like you. It costs money to produce shows like Radio Times. Help us defray the cost by calling 1-888-345-9499 and become a supporter of WHYY. That's 1-888-345-WHYY. Thanks.
The Kimmel Center supports WHYY and presents A Conversation with the Barefoot Contessa, featuring cookbook author and television host Ina Garten, Tuesday, November 12th in Verizon Hall. On stage, Garten delivers an insider's view of the world of the Barefoot Contessa, shares her natural approach to simple food cooked with love and passion, and engages the audience in an interactive question and answer session. The Barefoot Contessa, November 12th at the Kimmel Center. Tickets at KimmelCenter.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The less education you have, the greater likelihood that you will smoke. In some of the poorest sections of Philadelphia, 25 to almost 40% of residents do smoke. And that, of course, has numerous negative health and financial consequences. We're talking about all of this with Bradley Collins, who directs Temple University's Health Behavior Research Clinic, and Dan Romer, director of the Adolescent Communication Institute at the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. And we're taking emails at radiotimes@whyy.org. Brad, I'd like to go back to you because we haven't really talked about secondhand smoke, and I know that's something that you have been working on and looking at. And what can you tell us, or how can you get us up to speed on secondhand smoke?
Well, that I could give a whole two-hour lecture on
you
that.
You probably could.
But the, primary points to know is that there's no safe level of secondhand smoke. And children, the younger that they are more at risk for the dangers associated with secondhand smoke. You know, secondhand smoke has been associated or linked to numerous health consequences and is considered one of the leading preventable causes of death and illness, particularly in children. So it's associated with asthma, associated with respiratory illness. It's associated with SIDS. It's associated with cardiovascular and cancer risk. So it's a serious public health problem, and the CDC and the National Cancer Institute and other public health agencies have focused on the reduction of secondhand smoke, particularly in underserved and low-income communities, as a public health priority. So it is a big issue, and it's one that I'm thinking back to Dave, the caller, sure, you know, 5 minutes ago, that, you know, issues around secondhand smoke sometimes can help smokers. It's another motivating factor to help them consider quitting smoking.
Meaning that you don't want to do this to people who are living in your house or your apartment.
Exactly. Most of our work has been focused on parents because when it comes to children's exposure to secondhand smoke, residential smoking by parents is the primary source of exposure. So we do focus on parents, and we have found that messaging around secondhand smoke dangers and the benefits of reducing children's exposure as far as improving their health outcomes is a big motivator for parents to consider quitting smoking.
Have you found that as well? I mean, the idea of in a sense, protecting your children, that would be a good motivator, Dan?
It is. And, you know, we were asked by the city to do a survey of secondhand smoke exposure in families here in Philly with children under the age of 13. And a couple of my colleagues and I, Michael Hennessy and Amy Bleakley, did a large survey of over 400 residents in the city who have children under 13 and who smoke or have a family member who smokes. And about half the families reported that they do allow smoking in the home. which we were kind of surprised at. A majority of those folks think that it's okay to smoke somewhere in the home, but maybe not right in front of the kids. And as Brad says, you know, that's not going to necessarily solve the problem because smoke's going to be moving around the apartment or the home in any case. So the kids are still exposed. But the biggest – one of the biggest predictors of whether families will stop smoking in the home is how much they know about the health consequences for their kids. So those families that don't know as much are more inclined to allow that or to not put up a fight with other family members who say, I want to smoke. And if you can't give a good argument about why you shouldn't, those are the families that seem to be unable to do that.
Let me see what that looks like. Len from Overbrook Farms has to say. Len, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Do we have Len?
Thank you for accepting my call.
Absolutely.
I found out that I suffered from ADD most of my life. And I found out that I couldn't take prescriptions like Adderall, which is the only one that could help my ADD. And my doctors work with me in terms of smoking, but they found out that my smoking is related to ADD in the sense that it reduces it because I spend a lot of time writing and reading.
Well, you know, Len, I'm glad you called in because you're not the first person that I have heard say this. And I want to see what our guests have to say. And, Brad, I'm going to toss that to you. And we've been talking about smoking as a way of coping with things. And I wonder whether what Len has described makes sense to you, coping with ADD or ADHD.
Yeah, Len, you're not alone. For any smoker, smoking improves concentration, particularly with kind of monotonous or ongoing tasks such as reading or writing. So I understand why you would have extra challenge in trying to quit smoking. There's a biological basis for that, but also once a smoker learns that a dose of nicotine, which hits the brain in about 5 to 10 seconds, is going to improve their concentration, then that becomes the go-to strategy for a lot of people. And it can take some time. It's, you know, there is promise. There's, you know, working with a physician is a good direction to go, and I wouldn't give up on that. And talking about medications that can help your concentration as well as other strategies around the type of work you do, and maybe beginning to learn those strategies before you might try to quit smoking again is a strategy you could consider.
Lynn, I do appreciate the call to Radio Times, and good luck to you as well. Dan, let me toss something to you. Actually, we were talking during the break. Do people know how much they smoke?
Well, I don't think they're fully aware of it. We're doing a study now where we're asking people to save their cigarette filters in a little bag every day and bring them into us at the end of the week. And a lot of them are just amazed at, you know, how much they actually smoke. And the smell of these filters after collecting them for a week is very overwhelming. And, we've learned that maybe that's a way to even encourage smokers to reconsider what they're doing.
I mean, like aversive stimuli? I mean, the idea of just sort of negative reinforcement as opposed to positive reinforcement?
Yeah, really.
Do you like that idea, Brad?
Oh, it's a great idea. And I'm glad you're looking into that, Dan. It's, one of the things leading up to the quit day in for smokers and preparing to quit that can be really helpful and also after they quit is what's called self-monitoring to get a better handle on how many cigarettes one is smoking during the day and when they're smoking and some of the triggers around their smoking. And a lot of smokers do find that really helpful to begin to collect their cigarettes that week before they quit smoking and see how, gross it smells after some cigarettes start to accumulate in the ashtray.
Indeed it does. And again, that's Bradley Collins. Dan Romer joining us today on Radio Times, and we're talking about smoking and quitting smoking and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Bruce from Center City, Philadelphia to join us. Bruce, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I'm a very recent reformed smoker, but I'm relying very, very heavily on electronic cigarettes. The brand I'm using is a Blue. And my question, two questions for your guests. One is, do we have a point of view on the relative health impacts of the electronic cigarettes by themselves? One, and two, the potential impact of electronic cigarettes on people actually not being able to quit returning to traditional cigarettes.
Well,
I'll listen on the...
No, I appreciate your call. I just want to say we did a show about this a couple of months ago. You can go to our webpage and put in e-cigarettes and a show will come up. But I'd be curious about, well, again, Brad, let me go back to you. Are e-cigarettes healthy? Do we know?
I would not go so far as to say that e-cigarettes are healthy. You know, there is, you know, a lot of work that's going a lot of research. FDA is very interested in learning more about the dangers associated with e-cigarette use. But I get this question a lot, and I'm sure Dan does too, around this, are e-cigs a safer alternative? And I think a way to consider e-cigarette use is, you know, perhaps it's a safer strategy from a harm reduction perspective for someone who is trying to make the transition from smoking cigarettes to becoming an ex-smoker, not using any tobacco product. It could be a helpful strategy in that transition.
So the idea being less unhealthy, I guess, possibly.
Right, less unhealthy. I mean, you don't have as many of the constituents, the negative, you know, dangerous chemicals that are in tobacco smoke, but it's not safe per se.
Right. You want to weigh in on that, Dan?
Yeah, and, you know, we really don't know yet what's going to happen as these e-cigarettes start to proliferate and people try them. They are being marketed in a way that encourages people to think that they can quit smoking regular cigarettes. But we don't know. I mean, it could be that they're used indoors when you can't smoke a regular cigarette, and then when you go home or somewhere else, you smoke the regular. I mean, we just don't know how people are going to use these things. We also don't know if the vapor that comes out of them is like secondhand smoke in any way, because that could be a problem to have nicotine floating around in the air. So I think we don't know enough yet about the ultimate impact. And as Brad says, you know, they might be less unhealthy in the sense that they don't have all those awful constituents that are in tobacco.
But don't necessarily have to abide by the regulations for advertising for smoking actual cigarettes, right?
Or not yet.
Not yet.
FDA is working on that.
Just to kind of add to the drama here, let me see what Kyle from Allentown has to say. Kyle, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi.
I was listening and I heard the comment about self-monitoring. And I'm a board-certified behavior analyst, and I remember in my training, I learned about a study where smokers, all they did was count the number of cigarettes that they smoked each day, and that correlated with a decrease in smoking. And I was wondering if there are any other behavior analysis techniques that are useful for smoking cessation.
Kyle, let me toss that to Dan Romer.
Probably Brad's the better person. Let's
Well, let's toss it over to you, Brad. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I'm happy to take that, Kyle. There's a lot of research, a large body of research over the last few decades around the benefits of self-monitoring. I think what can tie into self-monitoring or piggyback on simply counting the number of cigarettes is helping clients understand when they are smoking, what are some of the triggers or the conditioned stimuli or cues that the person is reacting to that might be increasing an urge to smoke and leading them to smoke. And then using that information, if they're tracking the number of cigarettes they're smoking, the times of day they're smoking, what their triggers are before they're smoking, then you can help them develop compensatory or alternate strategies for managing their urge as a way to prepare them to quit smoking and to help them get through urges to smoke after they quit to prevent relapse.
Kyle, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And you're listening to Radio Times as we talk about smoking or quitting smoking. And again, our guests are Dan Romer and Bradley Collins. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is WHYY. I wonder, Dan, whether using celebrities, either you see, you know, as you said, we see less smoking in movies, although I feel like it's coming back a little bit, but nonetheless, Do celebrities have a role to play in terms of quitting smoking, getting people to quit smoking, or even getting them to start smoking because they are celebrities? Have you looked at that?
We haven't looked at it, but we're starting to look at what's on YouTube in relation to smoking and what kinds of videos are out there. And there's one that is kind of amazing, just shows celebrities smoking. You know, of all kinds. And we don't know if they're real or not, if they've been photoshopped or not. But there are YouTube videos out there that just show, you know, cool people with cigarettes. And, you know, I don't think that's happening by chance. I think there's some people who want to promote cigarettes by showing off celebrities. And, of course, movies, as we know, have been a big factor in smoking. And movies have famous characters, you know, actors up there on the big screen, and when they smoke, adolescents say that must be something that can't be too bad for you.
Do you think, Brad, it's sort of almost a silly question, but do you think it's possible to eliminate smoking? It's hard to imagine, but is there a number that we should get down to that you would feel would be a sign of success?
It's hard to imagine. I think, you know, it's cyclical. For every million people that are quitting smoking, you have, you know, a million people taking it up or trying smoking. And that's frankly one of my concerns with e-cigs, is that you have adolescents and people that otherwise might not have considered smoking cigarettes taking up e-cigs because it looks cool. And you see a lot of the advertising around e-cigarettes mimicking the successful advertising campaigns of the tobacco industry years ago. To answer your question directly, it is hard to imagine. So nicotine is a psychoactive substance. People who start smoking become dependent on nicotine relatively quickly. So I think you could lump nicotine and tobacco use in with other drugs of abuse and see that you can make major public health improvements and public health strides to reduce the number of smokers, but I think it's going to be a long haul and continue to take effort to prevent people from uptaking smoking as well as helping them quit once they start.
And for you, Dan, just 20 seconds, final thoughts here. I mean, we are talking about a leading cause of preventable death in this country.
That's right. And I think FDA, now that it has control over the marketing of tobacco, is going to play a major role in trying to get messages out there, reduce opportunities for adolescents to start the habit, and in general inform the public about ways to quit when they have smoked already.
Well, on that note, my thanks to you, Dan Romer, for joining us today on Radio Times. Bradley Collins, thank you very much as well.
Absolutely. Great to be here.
Nice to have you both here. And again, Bradley Collins, Associate Professor of Public Health at Temple University. He directs the Health Behavior Research Clinic. Dan Romer, thank you very much. As I said, Director of the Adolescent Communication Institute of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. We appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to learn much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.